I get so tired of people talking about like, oh, the pressure to be thin. Like, it is not the pressure to be thin. It is the pressure to not be fat. Like, we need to keep this in the conversation that it is anti-fat bias. It's fat phobic. Like, this is the cornerstone of diet culture, people.
Welcome to another episode of Bite Back with Abby Sharp, where I dismantle diet culture rules, call it the charlatans spinning the pseudoscience, and help you achieve food freedom for good. We are back, and I want to wish everybody a very, very, very happy new year. I hope you all had a restful and joyful holiday season. I just got back from a little warm holiday with the kiddos down south, so definitely was so nice to get a little bit of sun before coming back to the darkness that is Canada. No offense to my Capricorns and Aquarius friends, but January is not my favorite month. And not just because of like the shitty weather here in Canada, but because it is the month when diet culture messages become obnoxiously loud. And most of you guys know that I'm like vehemently against the whole new year, new you mantra that we will be inevitably hearing multiple times over the next few weeks. And I think just like being online at this time of year can be very triggering for a lot of folks who have been working on healing their relationship with their body and food. So, you know, if that sounds like you, maybe consider taking a little pause on your social media scrolling routine for like the next month or so and just sticking to audiobooks or podcasts like this week's amazing episode. How'd you guys like that plug? All right. Well, my guest today is the hilarious and super smart Lauren Hope Crass. Lauren is a comedian, a contributor to Betches Media, and the co-host of the Good Bodies podcast, formerly called Diet Starts Tomorrow. She's also a body positivity advocate and a fat activist, and I am honestly so excited to have her on our show. So today we'll be unpacking common misunderstandings and criticisms of the body positivity movement. We're going to be chatting about how weight loss drugs like Ozempic are affecting the fat acceptance community. We're going to talk about how straight size folks can act as allies to their larger body friends. And we're going to be talking some hard truths about thin privilege. No matter where you are in your body kindness journey, this is an essential listen any time of year, but especially as we are wading in some toxic New Year's resolution waters. Now, quick disclaimer, we will be briefly talking about disordered eating in today's episode, and my general reminder that the information in this episode is never a replacement for personalized healthcare. Also, I would love it if you would follow or subscribe to the podcast and also give me a little 5-star review and a comment, because as a new podcast, it really, really helps me out. All right, let's get into it. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Lauren. I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm thrilled to be here. I was really excited when your people reached out, because I was like, oh, I know who she is. I was like, I love her Instagram. Like, it's great.
Oh, I love it. And I love Good Bodies. I send it to so many of my friends and family. So thank you so much for what you do.
Oh my God. Thanks for telling people. That means a lot. And you're welcome. Thanks for all you do.
I love it. Okay. So, okay. Let's get into it. Talk to me, like, take me back to the beginning. Talk to me about kind of your history with dieting and your body growing up.
Sure. So I've always been a fat babe, okay? Always been plus size. I feel like my family was definitely a Weight Watchers family, you know? It was just kind of a part of the culture. I, for reference, I'm just turned 36. So, you know, I'm a millennial. I was, you know, the diet culture craze was like really heavy in like the 90s and early 2000s. So my grandma was going to Weight Watchers. My mom was going to Weight Watchers. I was a child in Weight Watchers, which, why is that legal?
Yeah.
Oh, why are we letting 12-year-olds weigh in? Uh-huh. And it is kind of like a nuanced thing for me to talk about, because I am really blessed by having like a really supportive mom And my grandmother was a great matriarch. Like, I was raised and surrounded by a lot of love. But I think as a child, the way it was positioned to me was like, oh, we're doing this for our health. We're getting in shape. You know, it was less of a, you got to be skinny to be hot. It was like, this is our community and what we do. And so I didn't really realize that it was toxic until much, much later, because again, like a lot of the community that people in bigger bodies have is dieting, you know? So I was just always trying different diets. I remember as like a young teen, I was like obsessed with those infomercials that would come out, and it'd be like Body by Jake. Like, I begged my mom for like
the shake weight.
Listen, I'm not that young. Oh. I was begging my mom for like these like really old school like diet programs. Like,
oh yeah,
we work with your specific body makeup and blood type, but we'll make you a program by Michael, or I don't know. But like, I was doing all of them. So, and then I think once I was in like high school, that's when it started to get more toxic. You know, like,
totally.
I know. You know, and your listeners know, like, restriction is not great. But like, when I was a kid and like when Weight Watchers, it was like fun, you know, it was like a family activity. But it wasn't until like high school when things did get a little bit more toxic, and like I was getting a lot of messaging like, you won't get a boyfriend if you don't lose weight, like you will not have access to love if you are not in a smaller body. And I just really believed that. And that's kind of where my like desire to be smaller came from. Like, it was never health. It was, I wanted to be loved. I wanted a boyfriend. I wanted attention, you know?
Wow. Yeah. I'm sure so many folks can relate to that story. And I'm so sorry that was, you know, the pervasive message growing up. That must have been like terrifying, because as women, you know, this, we are socialized to believe that, you know, our purpose is we're going to get married and fall in love, and it's this whole like prince and princess bullshit.
Yeah.
It does beg the question, like, if fat people do have more challenges finding romantic partner or finding love, which I'm not saying that's true necessarily or not, but is it because of their actual body shape or size, or is it because they've been fed these fat phobic narratives their whole lives about being unlovable and nobody's going to want you, that they believe it themselves, and that creates kind of barriers to confidence in dating and socializing? Like, what do you think those early messages perhaps did for your own romantic life?
I think it's a monster that kind of feeds into itself, you know, because you're right. It is a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're getting all these messages that you are not lovable in a certain body, you believe that, and then you project that, and then you are more insecure, and you maybe get into more, you know, codependent, borderline abusive relationships because you think that's like all you deserve. And then at the same time, it's like, we still do live in a very fat phobic culture, you know? So I do tell people, it's like, yeah, I'm very confident. I'm like very solid in who I am as a 36-year-old woman. However, I am aware of the world in which I live, and I am aware that I will be judged because I am judged.
Yeah.
You know? So it's kind of like, it reminds me of like confirmation bias, you know, like people tell you like, oh, nobody will love you if you're fat. And then it's like, oh, and then you're like getting rejected and you're like, oh, well, it must be true. And it's
must be true.
And right. And it's not true. I have lots of friends in bigger bodies, in happy relationships. Their partners are all shapes and sizes. I definitely, not to brag, I got men in my DMs. Okay.
I love that.
It's not true. It's just not true.
Right.
And I wish I could go back, but I can't. So,
but now you spread the message to so many other people, and that's so important, you know. But I'm kind of curious, like, what happened that led you towards like body positivity and fat activism and adjacent movements?
So I moved to New York when I was 24 to pursue stand-up comedy, and I think my whole story is like a bunch of accidents, and I'm so, so grateful. But when I moved to New York, I was, you know, I had no money. I was doing like a bunch of temp jobs and like running around. And I think at the time I was thinking that dieting was still something I quote unquote should do, but didn't have time to do. I think I naturally over time just stopped dieting due to being so busy. But then also a lot of anger came up with having dealt with dieting for so long. And I started doing what I'm pretty sure like other people think is intuitive eating, where I was just like, fuck diets. I'm going to eat whatever I want all the time, you know?
Yep.
And so I had no frame of reference. It was like, either you diet or you're a slob, you know? Like, I didn't know about intuitive eating, about like life is gray, like the middle ground, because we're brainwashed.
Yep.
To think that like
good, bad.
Yeah. So for years, I was just like eating like a little raccoon, like a little trash raccoon. And then it wasn't until 2018 where I like lost a job and I lost my health insurance and I reached out to New York State of Health and I was like, hey, I need health insurance. I lost it because my job was eliminated, no fault termination. And I didn't even ask for Medicaid. They just like sent me Medicaid. And I was like, oh, hell yeah. I went to the dentist. I did everything. I went to a dermatologist because it was free, you know? And I was like, yeah, I could try a nutritionist. Because I was aware, I was like, I'm not in great health. Like, let me talk to a nutritionist. And then God is real because the person I called, like the one person, and you might know her. I feel like all of you lovely, like intuitive eating nutritionists, like know each other, dietitians.
Yeah.
Rebecca Dickhoff. Do you know her?
Oh, yeah. I know. I do. I know her name. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was like the one person in network at the time. And I called her and, I was like, I'm not doing low carb. I'm not doing, like, I was just so feisty. And she was like, I'm not going to restrict anything. Like, come in, let's talk. And it just so happened that she was on like a professional journey of discovering intuitive eating. Like, she wasn't certified yet. She is now. Like, her practice is awesome. And they're all intuitive eating certified. But we kind of like discovered intuitive eating together. It was a really nice process. I read the book Intuitive Eating, the original one. I read the book Anti-Diet by Dr. Christy Harrison. And it was honestly, this seems so basic, but it was reading these texts. Like, that is my advice to people who are like, how do I break out of it? Read these books, okay? Because it will break your brain in the best way. And it will also make you feel so validated, so angry, like just so ready to take on a life where you are not wasting it trying to be smaller. Like, it was like 2018 where I really broke through. And once I discovered intuitive eating and the validation behind diets don't work, that's kind of when I was like, oh, this is just what my body looks like.
Right.
This body is not a problem. And that's kind of when I was like, I'm gonna flaunt it. This is gonna help people. I'm gonna accept the body that I'm in. It's a beautiful body. And so, sorry, that was a really long answer, but that is my...
No, I loved it.
That was my journey.
And you know what? I love it because I think so many people, including myself in a lot of ways, can like relate to that kind of progression, that from that black and white. Like, we have two modes in diet culture. We're either on the diet or we are off the diet and going hog wild. And that's allowed ourselves to
binge restrict.
Yeah. And so it's interesting because obviously, you know, my origin story is very different. That I've never lived in a larger body, but I suffered from an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And on my way from severe restriction to food freedom to where I am today, I also had this rebellion stage where I was kind of like, eat all the things, fuck it, going all in. And, you know, it's a process. And so
yeah,
it took time for me to kind of trust that I could listen to my body and know that I would honor my body. And so I think that, you know, while eating disorder, intuitive eating is not the eat whatever the fuck you want diet, like a lot of folks who will criticize it suggest it is.
Right.
It does start with that first stage of rejecting the diet mentality. So I think it makes complete sense that for a lot of us who were in such a, you know, a long-term problematic relationship with our bodies and food, that it takes that 360 moment to kind of to kickstart the journey.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people can probably identify with that progression. And it is a journey, right?
It is. I always try to tell people, like, intuitive eating is something you learn over a lifetime.
For sure.
You know, a lot of people, and it's, again, it's because we're trained with diet culture and these, like, this is going to change your life and transform and results in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Intuitive eating takes years. I started in 2018. Mm. It is now 2024, and I've only just now basically become alcohol free, which I'm not advocating people do alcohol free. It's just like, it took my body that long to finally be like, oh, you don't like alcohol. You know,
right.
Like it's just it is a slow burn. So when people are like, this doesn't work for me, I'm going to eat all the cookies, I'm like, keep trying.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a journey. It's like, you know, it's not going to happen overnight.
No.
And that's scary for a lot of people to hear who just want kind of like they've been dieting their whole life. And now they're like, oh, my God, I'm just going to eat everything I ever see then. And that may be true for a lot of folks who are just getting started with intuitive eating,
yeah,
who have been heavily restricted. Mm-hmm. There is going to likely be a period where you do kind of eat all the things that you've been restricting in the past.
Yeah.
But if you see it through and you build that trust and you build that body attunement, those skills, mm-hmm, then like you said, like, it took you how many years to realize, okay, maybe alcohol does not feel good to my body.
Yeah.
It's an act of self-care to not drink.
Right.
So I think, you know, thank you for sharing that, because I think it's definitely very relatable.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to body positivity, because I think, you know, there's a lot of these words out there, and I think a lot of people have a sense of what they mean, but don't really know what they mean.
Yeah.
How do you see a concept like body positivity versus movements where fatness is kind of front and center, like fat positive, fat liberation, fat activism, etc.?
Yeah. So I definitely identify as a fat liberationist, fat activist. I'm fat positive. I'm in the fat space. Like, that is true for me. I am also body positive. I feel like in the fat positive space and the fat liberationist space, there's a lot of talk about like body positivity doesn't help us. You know, I'm not body positive because learning to love my body isn't going to give me, you know, better care at a doctor, which is true, which is why fat activism is so important and is like my number one temple, you know. But within that temple, I love my body. I practice it, like loving what she can do. Yes, what she looks like. Like, I really don't, I mean, personally, I don't find it helpful to toss out body positivity. I feel like that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Like, it's one of those two things are true things where it's like, yeah, we need fat activism, but like body positivity also great. Like,
yeah,
there's a phrase, I forget who said it first. This is embarrassing, but like, there's a phrase in like the fat activism space where it's like, fat vanity is a survival tool that fat people teach each other, you know, and fat vanity, that's just like being cute and taking pictures,
right?
Well, accepting ourselves, and that helps us be mentally healthy, which is a part of overall health. So anyways, I'm getting really soapboxy here, but I'm not ready to release body positivity. I think it's very important. So
no, I love that perspective. And I think it totally makes sense in the way that, you know, perhaps body positivity may be vital for individuals' kind of own sense of self.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, fat activism, fat liberation may kind of help make the world more hospitable for larger bodies.
Yes. Like the social justice.
100%. Yeah. But okay, so I want to get your take on this because, again, I have no lived experience in a larger body. But it irks me when I see, you know, very straight size thin folks on social media take pictures of themselves, being like, see, I have roles too. If I just, you know, turn this certain way, hashtag body positivity.
Oh my God.
How does content like that feel to you, like, or even just straight size folks using the term body positivity in contexts like that?
Okay, well, let me say body positivity is for everybody. It was started by hot fatties. Okay, let's not forget our origin stories. But yes, Abby, like, that does drive me crazy. And I hope it's okay to say that, but like, it really, because again, a lot of our listeners are straight size and I love them. And this is for all of us, right? But it's just, I don't know. It's like, is it co-opting fatness? Like, if there's just something that does not pass the smell test,
yeah,
when a straight sized person is like, this is normal, this is normal, this is normal. And they're like sitting and scrunching, and then they straighten up, and then guess what?
They're gone.
They're skinny again.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And it's like, I can't sit up and my rolls are gone. I have rolls all the time. So it is sort of like, I don't know. It's like, it feels, I know they're not trying to be offensive, but it does feel like a little insensitive, right? Because, and it also feels a little bit like self-glorifying in a way when they show their bodies in these ways that do look societally acceptable. And it's almost like they do want to see what their body looks like that. And then they scrunch it and they're like, but it also does this. And I'm like, okay, congratulations. Like,
right.
You can also not look skinny.
Right. I do feel like it insinuates that, you know, roles are okay as long as you're thin.
Yeah.
Like, fatness is okay up until a very specific point where if you stand up straight, the fatness disappears, kind of thing. So I really don't think it helps anyone, including, you know, including other straight size folks who are seeing content like that.
Right.
And, you know, they're feeling insecure. It's toxic content in general to be comparing our bodies to one another.
It's so validating to hear you say that because I agree.
Yeah. And okay, so I want to kind of like elaborate on some of these ideas for a second, because I think, you know, when you've lived your life with thin privilege, you maybe don't realize how fat activism applies to you or like how anti-fat bias can affect you. But I would say, like, chances are for anybody listening to this podcast, like, you've probably struggled with your relationship with your body and food in some way, even if you've never been fat. You know, you've likely been fighting through restriction and diets, over-exercising, rules, like all of the dogma that we come across on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is fat phobia, and people don't realize that.
Yes.
Right.
Abby, thank you. I get so tired of people talking about like, oh, the pressure to be thin. Like, it is not the pressure to be thin. It is the pressure to not be fat. Like, we need to keep this in the conversation that it is anti-fat bias. It's fat phobic. Like, this is the cornerstone of diet culture, people. Like,
yes. Yes. And people need to understand that because, you know, like, fat phobia hurts us all. It kept me deeply entrenched in eating disorder for years.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, this is kind of why, you know, we often say like fat is a feminist issue, because, you know, fat phobia is designed to negatively affect all of us.
Right.
Even if, you know, kind of like what we were saying, like, it may be immediately dangerous to fat people for whom the world is not built for.
Yeah.
Clothes, rides, airplanes, healthcare bias.
Right.
Discrimination, etc.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it does none of us any favors.
Exactly. I'm so glad that, because you're like a really important voice in this space too, and I really appreciate that you understand that component and that you're shouting it from the rooftop. So
yeah,
as a fat, thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. And like, speaking of harm, because, you know, this is harmful for, you know, again, diet culture affects us all. I want to talk about how you see the age of Ozempic affecting the body positivity movement.
Sure. Yeah. I've been asked about this a lot. I feel like, well, let me say, you know, my fun little disclaimer, which is I'm very pro body autonomy. I'm never going to shame anyone for making a decision for their own body, no matter what that is, including taking a GLP-1 for weight loss, okay? So that's obviously true. Sometimes people don't realize that's true, but that is true. At the same time, a lot of people in bigger bodies are dealing with an increasing pressure to take GLP-1s, because before, you know, we could kind of say like, well, diets don't work. You know, so I'm going to choose to accept my body. That's like kind of a simple equation. You know, diets don't work. I'm in a bigger body. I accept myself. Deal with it. You know, now it's like there's this idea that GLP-1s and Ozempic and everything is like a proven way to keep the weight off, you know? And so the pressure it's almost like it's always been kind of a, it shouldn't be a political statement, but it's always kind of been a political statement to be in a bigger body and not trying to lose weight. Now it seems like it's an even bigger statement, because now there is this thing that, you know, actually keeps the weight off, but it's like, it's very expensive. It changes your, you know, your body, how your hunger cues can like communicate with yourself. You have to stay on it forever. Okay, like it is not an easy, quick fix. I mean, I've talked with people and they're like, this completely changed my life. Like, this is what I've been waiting for. But I feel like at the same time, it is catnip for people with eating disorders. Okay, it complete, like, and it is not being monitored very well. You know, like, if you are even in a slightly bigger body and you're at the doctor's office, they're going to say, take this. Okay. Like, we now have to arm ourselves with, like, all this, like, fat activism and body positivity, and, like, knowledge about how these drugs work to decide if we're going to take them or not. Like, if people aren't doing that, which most people aren't, they're just going to start taking these. And it just, it does worry me, because it's a lifelong choice and it is becoming really, the pressure to take it has gotten really, really strong for fat people. So it is, like, a little concerning for me.
Yeah, no, I can totally understand that. And, you know, like you, I'm all about body autonomy. And, you know, so again, I've got friends who are on Ozempic who feel it's changed their lives. And I'm so grateful that we have options for them and for others who feel the same. So,
right.
Again, I love that we have choice options, but again, so important to weigh out the risks and benefits for the individual. Mm-hmm. But on a social level, I often do worry that framing these drugs as, like, a cure for obesity just reinforces this dichotomous idea of thin equals healthy and fat equals unhealthy, when actually these things are not mutually exclusive and they also exist on a spectrum.
Right.
And not to mention, like, GLP-1s are ironically not without risk to your health. So you might lose weight, but we have evidence that, you know, without really strong counseling, like you said, a lot of that weight is going to come from metabolic muscle mass, and it's very hard to meet your basic nutrient needs, like from protein, omega-3s, fiber, micronutrients, when you're severely under eating. So I'm never ever going to discount the potential benefits of these drugs. I'm always very excited about innovations in science, but I do think it's a great example of how a smaller body doesn't necessarily mean instant health, right? Because you may be trading one risk for another, if there was even a health risk there to begin with. Like you said, like, if you're even a slightly larger body, then the doctor's going to be like, well, just take this. So we have to be cautious about that. Not to mention, I feel like fat people can't win because they're chastised when they don't actively diet to lose weight, but then they are in trouble or they're criticized for taking the easy way out when they take medicine.
I know.
Right? So
it's truly, and because of that, like, if anybody's listening to this and like, oh God, there's no, it's like, no, the way out is not giving a fuck. Okay. The way out is unsubscribing. Okay, because you cannot win by society standards. Okay, you are set up anti-fat bias runs so deep. Like, you cannot win that game. You have to exit the game. Okay, like, and you're right. Like, being, I call it, gosh, I'm being a little bit of a hater today, but I call it the health dance. Where they're like, it's for my health. And I'm like, you don't want to be fat. Like, I know a lot of people do have health concerns, but I feel like it's a health dance.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these assumptions just kind of reinforce all these fat phobic tropes about fat people being lazy, unmotivated. So they either don't want to diet or they want to take, you know, drugs to make it easy to kind of lose weight. And it doesn't obviously help anybody. So, yeah. But speaking of fat phobic tropes, I wanted to kind of ask about this, like, long-standing assumption that body positivity, or even just, like, actively not wanting to lose weight, or even, like, posting a photo of yourself in a bikini or whatever, is quote-unquote glorifying obesity. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are, that's ridiculous. I don't even like, nobody,
short answer,
nobody posts, like, a picture being like 5'2" and they're like, you're glorifying shortness. It's right. Like, I'm just not trying to have surgery to extend my legs, you know? Like,
right.
Also, like, let's state the obvious here. The O word, obesity, has, quote unquote, obesity has been used to stigmatize people in bigger bodies. So even putting that in the phrase is problematic, you know? Like, that's, it's used to take fat people down a peg,
right?
You know, nobody wants, because it breaks people's brains. And this is, okay, this, you're actually going to be surprised at this metaphor. This is why I think I had trouble when I was performing on cruise ships with, like, boomers in middle America, because they had been so steeped in diet culture for so long. It was like hard for them to see like a fat, happy, single, childless woman just like living her best life. It broke their brains. They hated it. They could not understand me, you know? And I think it's rather than to reflect on, oh crap, have I like wasted a lot of my time and energy trying to be in a smaller body when this other example, hello me, exists where you're in a bigger body and happy and fulfilled. It's like, that's a really hard conversation to have with yourself. And I get it. Like there is some mourning to be had. There is some grief to be had. So it's like, either you like are really mentally strong and you go through that grief of what you gave to diet culture, or you say, oh, well, they're just glorifying an unhealthy lifestyle and that's bad. And it's just like, no, this is what acceptance looks like. This is not, like, if I think of the term glorifying quote-unquote obesity, I think of, like, I don't know, like, a person in, an extremely bigger body, like, eating a tub of ice cream. It's like, nobody, but that's not what's happening. Like, eating a tub of ice cream and saying, you should eat a tub of ice cream, too. It's like, no, nobody is saying, like, when I'm posting a bikini pic, I'm not saying, you, too, can have this sexy, curvy body if you overeat. Like, that's ridiculous. It's stupid. I hide those comments. If you see them, delete them. They are lies. So
they are lies.
That is my thoughts.
I 100% agree. I always, when I hear comments like that, I just am like, do you understand the world we live in right now? Like, I get a lot of pushback, for example, from people telling me that I disproportionately criticize what I eat in a day videos that, you know, start with a thin woman doing a body check. And then people are like, well, why do you only criticize the skinny girls doing body checks? Like, why don't you call out the fat girls what I eat in a days or if they do a body check? And my answer to that is, one, well, largely because there's a far more, you know, problematic diet videos out there posted by thin women than larger bodied women. And B, the power of influence is never going to be the same. Because like you said, like if a thin woman puts her diet video, leaning into her angles, doing a body check, maybe not even showing her face, it's just like boobs down usually.
Yeah.
And then posts this kind of restrictive, disordered what in a day, there is this clear message, especially for people, that, oh, if you eat like this, you can look like this. And because
all bodies are the same.
Right. Like, exactly. Like, but because we live in diet culture, young people are going to try to copy that diet, even if it is super problematic. Because again, we're a culture obsessed with the pursuit of thinness. But when, you know, here in diet culture, fatness is not sought after at any or all costs the same way that thinness is. So, and this is not like skinny shaming.
Yeah, it's like a fallacy. Yeah.
Right, it's a full fallacy that fat phobic people play into to make it seem like, oh, you know, like this is a conspiracy against thin people. No, it's that, you know, problematic diet tips are still problematic.
Sorry, a conspiracy against thin people is really funny.
Right. But like, I feel like that's what people are trying to make it seem like is happening. But like, like the problematic diet tips are still problematic no matter what the person's size is who's sharing them. I've called out things that larger body folks have said that is complete misinformation or problematic content, especially like in the mukbang space.
Right.
But the risk to a young, vulnerable viewer is unequivocally disproportionate because people aren't saying, oh, I want to look like that fat person, so I'm going to do mukbangs too.
Right. No, literally nobody is doing that, which is, again, it's like nobody's doing that, yet how many people are using the phrase glorifying obesity? It's just completely disproportionate, does not exist. You're just trying to stigmatize a group of people.
Okay, so I wanted to close off, you know, what would you want or need from straight size folks to kind of help support you in these movements without kind of co-opting it as our own?
Great question. I have some easy things and then I have like a expert level thing. Okay. So the most basic thing you can do is not use fatphobic language. Okay. Like, don't say I feel fat. don't say, do I look fat in this? Does this? And I have friends who are very aware of my message and who I am, and they'll still let it slip and be like, does this make me look fat? I'm like, girl, like, just don't say that. You're implying that fat is gross and something that you never want to be, and that stigmatizes your friends. You know, like, anti-fat bias, it's not just like, oh, you don't want to be fat, but it's like, it's also, people forget, like, we are a demographic. Fat people are a group of people. And the more that you engage in anti-fat bias, the more you're like putting down like an entire demographic of people. So the most simple thing you can do is just don't use that language. I know it's tempting. We're raised in it, but just, that's baseline. Okay. Don't use fat phobic language. The second thing you can do, which is pretty simple, is when you go to a restaurant or event or anything like that, this is all you say. Straight size people, write this down. Do you have a preference on where to sit? Okay. Do you have a preference on where to sit? Because even the most fat activist of your friends isn't going to want to say, oh, I might not fit in that booth. Okay. It's humiliating to have to talk about our body size and have to like reiterate that the world isn't built for us. It's not fun. Okay. And on the flip side, even if you have a fat friend who is on a diet or whatever, they're still going to want to be comfortable when they sit down. So just say, do you have a preference where we sit? And if they say a table, don't say, oh man, why a table? Like, it's because the booth is too tight. Okay. Like, so just, that's a very kind thing you can say. And you're not even bringing up like, hey, due to your body size, where do you want to sit? You're just saying, do you have a preference on where to sit? And they will guide you. They know. And then the expert level thing you can do, people are going to hate this. You don't have to do it. I get it. We have the places that we like to shop. Shopping is personal. Shopping is emotional. I love fashion. Oh, I forgot to say fashion is a big part of how I found body positivity, by the way. Because I'm a girly girl and I love to dress up. And it's hard to do that if you're just covering your body in like droopy black clothes. Anyways, when you're shopping, try to see, I'm scared to even ask for it. Like, we don't want to ask for things. Like,
ask for it. We want to know.
I am like, we're so scared to ask for it. We would love it if you would try to mostly shop at places that have inclusive sizing, because
I love
it. Yeah, the fashion industry has really left fat people in the dust lately with the age of Ozempic. Like, it is hardcore and obvious, and it is plummeting. Like, it is, the plus size fashion space is in a really bad spot right now, and the brands that are still like the bastions of having like lots of sizes, like Universal Standard, places like that, like, shop there. Like, if that, you can cast your vote against fat phobia with your dollars, and it's fun. You're going shopping.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, so those are my tips.
Amazing. I think that's just so helpful for so many people that, you know, are just kind of getting started in understanding fat phobia, understanding the body positivity and fat activism movements. And I really appreciate you coming on to chat with me. Also, I'm obsessed with good bodies. Like, it's such a great podcast. So I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you again, Lauren. So nice talking to you. That was such a thought-provoking conversation, especially for someone like myself who has ultimately lived her whole life with thin privilege. For those of you who have struggled with your body image and weight your whole life, I am sure you heard yourself in Lauren's experiences. And for those of us with thin privilege, Lauren offered some really incredible and useful action items for our own learning and work. And I want to acknowledge that these two seemingly different experiences are actually not mutually exclusive, and that you can have thin privilege and also struggle with your body, be affected by discrimination, and ultimately be damned by diet culture and fat phobia. As we've discussed, that is why we are all here. But for those of us in straight size bodies, I do think it's important to understand and appreciate how our experiences differ. And that starts with understanding thin privilege. I don't know why thin privilege is so controversial, but it feels like anytime I say the words "I have thin privilege" in a video, I will inevitably get a ton of pushback from people insisting that it's not a real thing. Thin privilege exists for straight-sized folks, even if you hate your body, and I really wanted to give you just 5 of many examples of how that privilege for thin folks, or conversely, disadvantage for larger body folks, plays out in real life. Number 1, healthcare discrimination. If you're able to go to the doctors for literally anything, so like a rash, a persistent cough, anxiety, and the first recommendation isn't automatically weight loss, you probably have thin privilege. It's well documented that at least 60% of larger bodied women have experienced fat phobia from their healthcare provider. One study found that doctors who specialize in clinical management of obesity displayed strong weight bias and used words like lazy, stupid, and worthless to describe their fat patients. And this does cause harm. Larger body individuals often experience shorter appointment times, less comprehensive exams, fewer referrals for specialists and imaging, and longer wait times for surgeries and other procedures. One study, for example, found that larger bodied women are less likely to be screened for cancer and are more likely to die from these cancers when compared to normal weight women with cancer. Now, number 2, the fat fashion tax. If you're able to walk into virtually any store and find your size in clothing, you likely have thin privilege. As Lauren described, not only do larger bodied folks have fewer clothing brand options, but the options that they do have often cost more money. So for example, a plus size t-shirt at Target could be nearly 20% more expensive than the same straight size shirt. And while a lot of companies may argue that it takes more fabric to make a 2X garment than an extra small, it does seem kind of strange to be basing prices off of the extra small when almost 70% of American women are over a size 14. So extra small is actually the minority here. Number 3 is work discrimination. If you haven't been overlooked for a promotion or job you're qualified for because of your weight, you probably have thin privilege. One study found that HR professionals were more likely to disqualify larger body people from being hired and less likely to nominate them for supervisory positions. Another study found that larger body job applicants were more likely to be viewed as being less conscientious, less agreeable, less emotionally stable, and less extroverted than their normal weight counterparts. And this discrimination disproportionately affects women, where larger bodied men are less likely to be judged or disadvantaged compared to the same size women, where beauty standards play a bigger role. For each 1 unit increase in a woman's BMI, they receive 1.83% lower hourly wages. So yeah, that's wild. Number 4, accessibility in the world. If you're able to fly on any airline or eat in any restaurant seat or fit in any car or ride any roller coaster, you probably have thin privilege. In a lot of cases, like on special rides or in small restaurants or in many vehicles, there may just not be an option for a larger body person to participate. In other cases, like flying internationally, we again see the fat tax, where larger bodied folks are required to pay for 2 seats. Now, some countries, including my own Canada, have adopted a one person, one fare policy, which prevents domestic airlines from charging passengers that require an extra seat an additional fare. But there's still a really long way to go to make the world more accessible to folks in larger bodies. And number 5, limited media representation. If you see bodies like yours in media in starring roles like TV, movies, ads, and fashion, you probably have thin privilege. In contrast, fat characters in media are almost always one-dimensional. They either serve as the funny, goofy, dumb friend, which simply reinforces fatphobic stereotypes, or they're reduced down to a weight loss story arc and are always trying to prove they're worthy of love or friendship despite their weight.
Consider like Fat Amy in Pitch Perfect as the former and Bridget Jones as the latter, who, despite fatness being central to her whole identity, was literally a size 10. But I digress. Finally, let's talk about public judgment. If you can eat or talk about or just interact with food, literally any food, without being watched, lectured, or judged, you probably have thin privilege. In my experience as a thin person, I can eat pizza or dessert, and either people will say nothing at all, or might even make a comment that I'm like such a cool girl for not ordering a boring salad. In contrast, larger body folks' food choices are constantly surveilled and critiqued. They will get comments or lectures in the grocery store, at restaurants, at family events, at work, and perhaps most viciously, on the internet. It is really, truly fucked up. Recognizing thin privilege doesn't mean ignoring or not validating your own struggles with your body and food, but it is crucial in helping us challenge the fat phobia and diet culture that ultimately harms us all. And that is all that I have for you guys today. Another huge thank you to Lauren Hope Crass for helping me bite back against diet culture. You've got to check out her podcast, Good Body, so I'm going to be linking to it in the show notes below. And don't forget, please leave me a review. It really does help me out as a new podcast to get the word out. Signing off with Science and Sass, I'm Abby Sharp. Thank you for listening.